This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear how the town and the city might move past the he said, she said phase of the Metro Zone dispute. The town council discussed it at their Monday meeting.
People that know me and how I think and act, the idea that I would threaten somebody with a lawsuit, no, I don't threaten people.
Hear what Town Mayor Chris Koos says about where the community goes from here and about the new town budget. Discover how nature and found materials meet in the art of Bill Conger. Laura Kennedy walks through the latest exhibit with the artist. And we remember BCPA Director Tina Salamone. She died unexpectedly Monday, Judy Valente reports. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's March 7th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT. With additional support from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group, more information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington Normal continues to absorb the sad news of the sudden death on Sunday of Tina Salamone. The 58-year-old director of the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts died from a heart attack. Salamone arrived in this community in December of 2013 and immediately brought a personal touch to her work. She solicited ideas from community members on the kinds of performers they wanted to see. She brought in a variety of artists, ranging from classical musicians and country and western singers to poets and stand-up comics. GLT's Judy Valente has this appreciation of Salamone's life and work.
She was as much a fixture at the Performing Arts Center as its tall staircases, elegant ballroom, and wide balcony. She attended nearly every performance, personally greeting the audience from the stage before the start of the show. So it was hardly a surprise to those who knew her that Salamone had been at work at the center on Sunday, just hours before her sudden death.
You know, that woman was always at work.
Tricia Stiller of the Downtown Bloomington Association was a close friend of Salamone's and often collaborated with her on arts projects.
I'm sure she was probably planning ahead for next season and trying to get in the best acts possible for our community. She had a really great sense of what this community wanted in terms of entertainment and what acts to bring in that would generate interest in the community. And so she was working it. I'm sure she was looking at opportunities to get headliners to come to town.
Friends said she had been suffering from flu-like symptoms and had asked a friend to take her to the emergency room Sunday afternoon. In an interview last August about the 10th anniversary of the BCPA, Salamone shared with me her vision of a performing arts center that would both appeal to a diverse audience and reflect the diversity of our community.
What I look for when I'm programming is, of course, I don't want to alienate the crowd that is already there, the folks that might be 10 or 15 years older than I. But I want to see things that I want to see, and I certainly want to look for artists that are entertaining, engaging, have an educational component, that will do in-service in the community in one way or another, and that will be representative and vital to people who aren't coming to the Arts Center and giving them a reason to come.
Salamone worked to make the imposing, classically designed Performing Arts Center a welcoming place, often appearing in informal flowing pants and non-traditional shoes.
Because there's some people that, you know, still feel that maybe they don't have the right shoes or they don't have the right, sense of etiquette to come to the BCPA, and those things are just non-existent. You don't need a certain pair of shoes to come there. I go in there in tennis shoes all the time.
I've seen them. They're great tennis shoes.
Thank you.
She tirelessly promoted her facility to performers, singing the praises of its seating and acoustics to entice them to come to Bloomington Normal.
The seats are very intimate, so this works particularly well for true storytellers, stand-up comedians, singer-songwriters, those people that aren't surrounded by a lot of production. Solo performances are beautiful in that space, and the acoustics are wonderful, too. So it's not hard to convince people for that reason, because they know they can tell their story there very well. It's also strategically, we're at the confluence of three interstates, 55, 74, and I always forget about 39. So as people are driving around, you know, coming down from Madison, Wisconsin, or coming over from Indianapolis, we're right here just a couple of hours away from everything, and that makes for a very nice tour schedule.
She brought an eclectic sensibility to the shows she booked. They ranged from a Beatles tribute band and Sinatra songbook interpreter to Hal Holbrook as Mark Twain, country western singers, a cappella groups, and even a marching band that plays the Great American Songbook.
It doesn't matter to me, really, who's on stage, as long as it's a quality performer that will have a meaningful exchange with the audience.
Salamone worked previously at the Burlington Capitol Theater in Iowa before coming to Bloomington in December 2013. Stiller of the Downtown Bloomington Association said Salamone never lost the common touch that came from her beginnings in the South Chicago suburb of Burbank.
You know, I'm devastated. It's a devastating loss for me personally. We had become fast friends, having grown up in the same suburban area. We kind of had a language shortcut that we understood, and that was very comforting. But for the community, I've never known quite a visionary of Tina's caliber, and she was always three steps ahead in her ideas and her energy and what she envisioned Bloomington and Normal could be.
Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner called Salamone's death a tremendous shock.
Tina always brought a great sense of energy and creativity and ideas to her job. She was extremely dedicated. This is a huge loss for the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts.
Renner said the city will determine a way to honor Salamone in the coming days. And Stiller called her a unique and creative soul.
With so much talent, just so much ability. I'm grateful that our community was fortunate enough to have her. Even though it was for a very short time, her impact will be felt forever. The lives she touched and the changes and the differences that she made will be here always.
Tina Salamone was 58 years old. I'm Judy Valente.
Salamone was also a director and performer. She was a cast member in the BCPA's 10th anniversary production of Love Letters and directed some of the summer musicals in Miller Park. At the time of her death, she was working on revitalizing a creativity center where arts groups could come together in a shared home. Jay Tetzloff, director of Bloomington's Parks, Rec, and Cultural Arts Department, vowed to keep the creativity center project moving forward in Salamone's honor. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
For GLT comes from Dr. Stephen Motter of the Gastrointestinal Institute, reminding people over 50 to get screened for colon cancer. March is Colon Cancer Awareness Month. Early detection saves lives. Information at ilgastro.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The town of Normal passed its next budget last night, talked more about the much-talked-about Metro Zone Agreement, and discussed the town council's public comment rules. In the studio, as he is most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings, is Mayor Chris Koos. Chris, thanks for coming in today.
Good afternoon.
The Metro Zone Agreement is not dead?
In our opinion, it is not dead. We are holding to the letter of the law and the agreement that the agreement can't be altered or rescinded without the agreement of both parties. And that's our position going forward.
Is this semantics? In effect, is it dead?
That's hard to say. That's a very hard question to say. If you talk to three or four of Bloomington aldermen, their answer would be absolutely it is. If you talk to a couple of others, they'd say, well, it may be, but, you know, we'd like to see something happen on a more collegial ground. If you ask the town of Normal people, they're going to say no.
When
or maybe never is the answer, but when will the town move on?
You know, we're going to have some little discussions on that going forward. I think I see this as going in parallel. I think I see trying to figure out the Metro Zone on one timeline and figuring out how we do the rest of the things in our community collaboratively or not on another timeline.
How likely is it, do you think, Bloomington would actually reopen the negotiations? You said four or five council members probably don't want to go there.
Wow, that's a question you're going to have to ask them. I think we've kind of asked it in a firm but polite manner last night, so it's kind of in their court right now.
What was the strategy behind the strongly worded news release last week that called Bloomington a competitor, not a partner, and demonstrably untrustworthy? What's the end game there?
I think frustration. I think there was a lot of frustration that boiled up. Frankly, you should have seen the first version of that statement. And I think it spurs from the fact that there was so little discussion and the portrayal that there was all this active discussion, I think, really made us mad. And so we reacted accordingly.
Lashing out never helps, though, does it?
Well, no. But sometimes you do it anyway.
You felt better afterwards, perhaps. So there was no effort to reframe the conversation from the amount of money that's been exchanged in the agreement to more of a focus on the actual partnership?
Never. Never. So the only discussion that we had that I was involved in was, are you willing to talk about doing this, extending the agreement, modifying the agreement, rescinding it over a period of time? Are you willing to do any of those? And the answer was, we feel that from Bloomington, they felt that their only option was to rescind the agreement without discussion and then reopen negotiations and talks.
So I have to ask if there's something else going on here. It seems like a lot of strong words, a lot of angst on both sides for what amounts to $1.2 million over 1 year or $2.4 million over 2 years. Not small change, but is it worth the damage that's occurring to the relationship between the town and the city?
I think my counsel was very clear and very descriptive and demonstrative in the fact that the larger issue is how do we move forward with an agreement when we have a partner that won't talk to us about how we deal with the current agreement. I think that's the issue. I think the level of trust, as I said before, we'd had agreement verbally from five aldermen in the city of Bloomington to put the brakes on this thing and have a discussion. But at the end of the day, when the vote was taken, there were only two that held that position.
Well, let's talk about future agreements. In the news release from the town of Normal last week, it states Mayor Renner has been using BN Advantage to justify the Metro Zone action. In fact, the actions of Mayor Renner and the city council directly contradict the collaborative mission of BN Advantage. Unilateral action is not collaboration, end quote. Can you briefly discuss BN Advantage? What is it and what impact this spat between the municipalities might have on that economic development effort?
Well, the Bloomington Normal Advantage is an economic development policy or program, if you will. It's not an entity like EDC or the Chamber. And the idea was that we have much more to offer potential businesses and our current businesses if we are going together as one entity with a common cause. And part of that, I think Paul Harmon explained it very well last night in his comments, and you might want to refer back to those, to take agreements like the Metro Zone, which was kind of textbook from what BN Advantage described as future collaborations, and say this is no longer viable and we don't want to talk about it. Well, of course, people are saying, well, what is it? Are you collaborative? Are you promoting as a region? Or are you, siloing up?
So where does this economic development project go from here? Is BN Advantage dead?
I'm not going to say that. I don't feel that way. Is it damaged? Yes. Can it be resolved and move forward? I would certainly hope so. But it's going to take all the parties to agree to do that.
What are the options the town is weighing now? Where do you go from here?
We haven't started the discussion on that. You know, we kind of kicked around it a little bit, but
you're looking at intergovernmental agreements.
Yeah.
You may have to cut $1.2 million out of the budget.
If we don't get agreement, we're definitely going to have to cut $1.2 million out of our budget. And that's going to be difficult. That's not going to be an easy thing to do. We run a pretty lean budget. The community demands that, and we respond to that. So, you know, we're going to have to take a look at that. But again, I think my personal choice would be to move in those parallel timelines that I was talking about. I don't think one wholly depends on the other. There is interdependency, but I think the two can move together.
So one of those parallels might be continue to talk about the Metro Zone, but also continue to cooperate with BN Advantage.
Yeah.
Litigation, is that still on the table?
We haven't talked about it.
That's not a yes or a no.
Well, we haven't talked about it. You know, we purposefully did not engage in that. We know people wanted a quick answer, or are you going to sue them or not? We didn't feel that was an appropriate path to take. So is it an option? Of course it is. But we haven't made any decisions or had any discussions.
The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Mayor Terry Renner is in next week. You're listening to Mayor Chris Koos in today. What do you want to say about the budget that was approved last night?
I think the strength of the budget, given some trying times, you know, this community is seeing some issues with sales tax coming in. Our workforce is declining a little bit, so our state share of income tax is going down. I thought the budget did a very good job of responding to that while trying to be an eye on the future and being open to growing this community. I think there was very good discussion on debt management, the amount of debt that the town has, its ability and capacity to handle that debt easily. And talking about pension funding, too. It's a big issue in the state of Illinois, but the state said you need to be fully funded in your pensions, or 90% funded in your pensions by 2040. Our goal is to be 100% funded, and we're moving to that goal.
There's a fee increase, a sewer rate hike. How big and why?
That has not been done. It's in the budget as a future.
So a separate vote on that?
Yeah, there has been no vote on that. And there's a sewer study that either is underway or will be done pretty soon to kind of give us some reference on what we may or may not need to do.
Any other fee or tax hikes in this budget?
Not that I'm aware of.
Let's talk about transportation and mobility for a moment. First, an uptown traffic study, that's in the budget. Uptown 2.0 has some significant changes regarding traffic patterns around uptown. What is the Far Associates Master Plan trying to accomplish, and what will the town be looking at?
Well, it's trying to accomplish a number of things. It's trying to accomplish movement through the new section of the uptown in maybe a little traffic calming way where people would slow down and see what's there, better use of the roads, adopting a complete street standard for that, and taking a look at how one-way patterns on Mulberry and College may or may not affect future development along that corridor.
Some one ways around uptown. College and Mulberry may turn into two ways.
Correct. Now, you know, these are all recommendations from the FAR group, and they acknowledged we're not traffic engineers. You know, we have an understanding of this, but the theories that we are espousing need to be tested by a traffic study.
And that's the reason for the traffic study in the next budget. I think it was about $100,000.
Correct.
Staying on mobility for a moment, sidewalks. Bloomington has a sidewalk master plan. What is the state of the town's sidewalks?
The town has had what we call a 50-50 program, where if a homeowner wants to replace some sidewalks, we'll pay 50% of it on the front. Now, if we see an area where the homeowner can't afford it, is unwilling to do it, and the sidewalks reach a state of significant disrepair, or we have situations where you have slabs heaving because of trees, things like that, we'll go ahead and do those. And usually it's people raising the awareness of it to us and saying, hey, we got a problem.
Not a lot of money in the $132 million budget, $50,000. Is that an increase? And you mentioned that is part of the town's 50-50 plan?
Yes, it is part of the town's 50-50 plan. I couldn't answer if it's an increase or not. That's roughly the amount of money we allocate.
What kind of focus is there on Uptown with this budget?
There's not a significant focus. There are some things that still need to be done in the Uptown. We've still got two very large redevelopment sites. We have some activity around those sites, but nothing that we can say we may have to budget for that. I think what we're looking at in the long term, you know, we're putting some numbers out there in years 3, 4, and 5, but I can guarantee you those will change because we don't know enough about the landscape to say those are firm numbers.
$600,000 for land acquisition south of the tracks. Is there a particular parcel in mind, or is there just this is just a some money to move forward when land becomes available?
Yes.
So both.
I don't have to remind you, land acquisition issues are usually done quietly. There's a myriad of reasons for it, and they're protected by Open Meetings Act. So, to my memory or knowledge, there is no specific project we're going after.
That's Mayor Chris Koos. He stops by Sound Ideas every other Tuesday following Town of Normal Council meetings. State legislation has been introduced, inspired by the town's public comment section of council meetings. Is this why you're proposing a new public comment policy?
Not really. In fact, I'm pretty annoyed by this state senator, state representative in the Geneva area. You know, what's going on in the state with the budget issues, he's worried about Town of Normal's public comment policy. I think he's got more important work to do. To give you an idea, this legislative session, there are 6,500 bills that have been filed. And we've been told by people who watch this very closely, roughly 800 of them will get to committee and out. And my guess is this is going to be one of them. What kind of influenced our public policy comment is a basket of things. Citizen concern, council concern. There were a couple of people on the council that felt we were too rigid on that. Advice from our legal staff. They were saying, you know, it might be too tight. We wanted to hear from the Attorney General. It's taking forever to hear from them. So, you know, a couple of conversations one-on-one with council members. I kind of saw that where the landscape was going and asked them if they wanted to do it. And they all pretty much said, yeah, let's go ahead and do it.
The current policy is once every 45 days, speakers have 2 minutes. There's a 10-minute limit for all speakers. How might the policy change? What did you ask for?
So what we're looking at is eliminating a 45-day rule altogether. Come to any meeting, every meeting. 2 minutes to 3 minutes, and frankly, I always allowed 3 minutes. I never liked the two-minute rule. That's awfully brief. So as long as I've been doing this, I've been allowing 3 minutes of conversation, and we'll go to 20 minutes of public comment. Now, having said that, sometimes there are hot issues in the community, and we've done this before. Well, we'll rescind the rules and allow 45 minutes of public comment, an hour's worth of public comment, depending on the issue and the public's need to elaborate what they're doing. We had those kind of issues with some student apartment developments years ago, some of the early Uptown projects. We had lengthy public comment sessions.
So some early discussion I heard, there was going to be a limit on how many times an individual could address the council, maybe 13 times a year.
Right.
Is
mm-hmm.
that still in the works? Or
no.
So
no.
Are you concerned then, based on what we see in Bloomington, that you might see what I call frequent flyers at the council meeting, where it's the same thing over and mm-hmm. over again? They adopt this stance where it sounds like the council is being scolded or talked down
right.
to. I don't know if that's, I guess I wonder if you think that's productive and if there should be more of a limit in terms of how many times someone can speak to the council.
Well, yeah, I don't approve of that. I don't think it's a good use of public comment to have people get up and berate the council week in and week out. It accomplishes nothing, you know.
Opening that up, the normal council?
No, because we are still maintaining it has to be germane to the agenda. You can't get up and talk about how you think your councilman's doing. That's not an agenda item. And frankly, under our 45-day rule, we saw some people taking broad liberty with sneaking in comments that weren't germane to the agenda. We're going to be a lot tighter about that.
How often are public comments an opportunity to actually get anything done? If you come to the council and your first contact with council is to complain about something or ask about getting something done, does staff then circle back with that individual, or are there better ways to actually sort of have the first conversation?
Well, there's lots of ways to have a conversation. I get stopped on the street. I get emails. I'll get a phone call every now and then. I'll get people that'll talk to me before a meeting, things like that. And then we get public comment. Now, I won't argue with the statement that people that make public comment want it on the record and that's why they do it. I understand that.
And it could be a legitimate reason to do
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely. No question of that. But there are a myriad of ways to get your point across to the council. Now, having said that, if you come and speak at a public comment and say, on this item, I don't agree with what you're doing. Well, there's not going to be any staff follow-up on that. You just made a comment you don't agree.
Okay. Chris, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas, as always.
Always good to be with you.
Chris Koos is running for his fourth full term. Is that correct?
That's
as mayor?
That is correct.
The election is April 4th. You're listening to 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Radio Lab.
Confrontations.
Punching, kicking.
Face-offs.
Can't believe he just did that.
Whoa.
It kind of hurt.
Throwdowns.
It was a big blowout fight.
She just starts attacking him.
Lefties versus righties. Sharers versus stealers. Friend versus friend. Showdowns on the next Radio Lab. Listen Sunday at 11 on GLT News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Community Cancer Center, dedicated to increasing cancer survivorship by providing leadership, prevention, and integrative state-of-the-art services covering the continuum of care. Located at 407 East Vernon in Normal. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The simplicity of an art installation. A Peoria-based artist builds relationships between the nature of found materials and the interpretive impulses of the mind of the viewer. Laura Kennedy has more at the Merwin Gallery with artist Bill Conger.
There's just two pieces in artist Bill Conger's new show in Illinois Wesleyan University's Merwin Gallery. And that leaves a lot of room for viewers to challenge themselves and to explore the possibilities within the works. Entitled Two Open Windows, the exhibition is dominated by a huge rectangle of green fabric on the floor. Artfully must, it's a singular landscape in the otherwise empty space. Conger says this piece was inspired by the space it fills.
I was invited to do this exhibition, this beautiful space at Illinois Wesleyan, and it's so tempting because of the size to put in many objects or, you know, past works to kind of show what you've been up to for the past year or two, but I thought it's such a perfectly symmetrical rectilinear room with beautiful dark ceiling. I couldn't let it go, so I wanted to produce a work for the room.
So this is specifically for this show?
It is. This was designed for this room and probably will not fit into another one just right again. So I'm really excited to have that experience. It does present an economy of object to spatial ratio, as you can see here, but I'm very excited by the austere kind of quality that the exhibition comes off with. We're just talking about two works. The two works in combination are the show, and therefore kind of become one work. The show is called Two Open Windows. The phrases, the titles that I kind of create are purposely ambiguous to some degree. They also can be abstracted in terms of how you hear them. So if I write Two Open Windows, there's a very specific way you might read it, but if I say it, you're not exactly sure if I'm talking about the number or the...
Or to open a window, or we've got two windows.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
So there are many ways of kind of discerning what this is, which is purposeful.
Yeah,
so,
do you delight in that?
I do. I'm really excited about finding abstraction in places that we're in every day. So language we're in all the time. When I bring language into a gallery situation, it all of a sudden becomes something different, and we have to think about it in a different way. So for me, that's potential to push what I'm talking about as abstraction historically in how we assess, how we gauge, how we make sense of the world and the things that we do every day. And by shifting that context a little bit, I think that's what helps me propel the mystery of the pieces as well, because they're also very simple, like languages. They're found objects in general, which is not a new way of working. It's a century old now. It's not cutting edge or anything like that. But what I'm trying to do with these objects, or the things that I kind of develop a fascination with, is to provide an experience that I have had with them, which provides the viewer a place to meditate on them, to obsess on them, to think through their formal qualities, and then investigate the titles and the context that I provide for them. So hopefully it all changes. So the aforementioned fabric that you were talking about on the floor is a parachute.
I thought it looked like parachute material, but it's green, and it actually looks like it could be like curtain material.
It could. It kind of resembles a sleeping bag or a rug. It also kind of mimics a kind of grave plot or many different things. It also looks like a topographical map or waves.
Yeah, it's must throughout the whole thing.
Right.
It's not completely flat. It's
exactly.
Must. Is that very deliberate mussing?
It is. Yeah, it's kind of teased mussing for sure. The shape of the parachute is round, but I've shaped this to a more painterly rectangle.
Well, it mimics the room.
Correct. Exactly. So I'm allowing, I think, for a little more of a painterly read onto this. I am using that word lightly. This is not painting or anything like it, but I come from a painting background, so I can't get away from the rectangle and its brilliance, really, and how it creates a place for us to meditate and think about things.
So you don't see that as limiting at all?
Not at all. No, I think it's as opening. It allows for new reads on things, which is what I'm trying to push into. I'm not trying to come up with something formal that you've never seen before, but a place where you can maybe slow down and think about the work in a way that it can unfold like poetry or literature does. It's time-based like literature. It kind of layers on itself. And then if it does its job, this could actually resonate to the viewer long after they're in this space. They can continue thinking about the relationships, the text, the things going on within the pieces.
You know, there's going to be some people kind of like me who will walk in here who want to straighten this up. So I feel a little bit uncomfortable because I actually, it's like a rug or something, and I want to straighten it out. I want to get those wrinkles out. So it's making me, as much as I admire it.
Some OCD.
Yeah, I'm getting a little OCD
maybe.
Thing going on here.
And that is, you know, part of what I love about the work that I'm making now is that as much as you try to make this stuff into what you want it to be, it always kind of wins. It always has this material is so buoyant and strange that it looks very easily flattened out. However, it has a mind of its own. It's a very interesting material that way. So sculpturally, it actually does present a lot of challenges in terms of how you mess with this, how you deal with it.
Down at the far end of the gallery, we have something else of yours, and we're just going to venture down that way.
So from afar, you probably may think that it's a void of some kind, a hole in the wall.
Yes, I thought it was a hole in the wall.
Right.
And we're getting closer, and it's not.
It is an object indeed. This is actually a 19th century tintype photograph.
Really?
On a quarter plate, which is a little larger than we are accustomed to seeing tintypes, which are usually a couple inches by a couple inches.
Mm-hmm.
This is a little bigger than that, and that helps with the scale of the room. It also is just big enough that perceptually from the end of the room when you come in, it appeared to be a kind of void.
I thought it was a window.
That you might walk towards.
Yes.
So, hence, two open windows is coming into play again. So hopefully this gets the viewer in movement through the space, thinking about the text, thinking about the objects.
You get drawn back because you want to take, I wanted to like to stick my head into it.
Right.
Not that my head would fit, but.
The interest of when you see the material list, you'll learn that it is a tintype photograph. It's also reversed to the wall. So the image is being withheld from you. And she is a woman, a seated lady, who is facing into the wall. So her gaze never finds yours. You are kind of perceptually held apart by the back of this thing, which is the only part of this that you're allowed to see.
It's interesting because now she is an unwilling participant in an art exhibition many years after her death.
It's a little bit of an irreverent move to take something as antiquitous and beautiful as this photograph is and withhold it from the public. And to place it against the wall is a kind of, I think, a strange bit of irreverence in that. I kind of like that that had a little bit of rudeness to it. I mean, it also gets you thinking about the material in a different way, photography in a different way, what it means to be an image on a piece of tin or paper or whatever, that our visage maybe is a symbol of something.
And it's not just plain black on the back side. I mean, you could really see, you can kind of make out various shapes and, you know, grades of color and that sort of thing. And, you know, I'm actually already trying to project what this actually could be.
Absolutely.
I'm trying to turn it into something.
It also has a painterly, I mentioned I had a painter background, and to me it was like a nocturne or something.
Yes, yes. Like I say, and these is like the this is like dusk, and there's like an edge of trees here, and there's a sofa sitting
exactly.
in the middle of a field, and I don't know why I see it that way. It's like a Rorschach inkblot.
And that is what I really invite to happen. There are probably meanings behind why I chose these things. Completely irrelevant. They really should not matter to the viewer whatsoever. What the choices I made have nothing to do with what the viewer should be. If the viewer finds themselves interested enough that they want to pursue this and kind of go farther into it and think deeper and deeper, their experience becomes their experience, and it's totally valid.
And your job as an artist is done.
I think so. I mean, I always hope that somebody gets something out of it. I am aware that the simplicity of a minimalist installation type of show may push people away. I hope that doesn't, you know, I'm always hoping that people can get interested. But I think there is a lot here within the simplicity of what you walk into. It can become very deep, and that's what I'm really trying to make happen for the viewer.
That's artist Bill Conger. To Open Windows continues at the Merwin Gallery at IWU in Bloomington through March 30th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
A gallery curator for many years before going full-time as an artist, Bill Conger says he misses curating and so has opened a small special project space in the warehouse district of Peoria to allow him to showcase the work of other artists. You're listening to Sound Ideas. We'll be right back.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. With the record-breaking popularity of the Broadway musical Hamilton, there was bound to be interest in reviving another musical about America's founding fathers, this one about the men who signed the Declaration of Independence. The musical 1776 shows John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and others in their array of human qualities. The show won Best Musical in 1969 and was made into a popular film right before the U.S. Bicentennial in 1976. The new production at Illinois State University's Center for the Performing Arts takes its cue from Hamilton in that it makes use of color-blind casting. GLT's Judy Valente talks with director Laurie Adams and dramaturge Kelly Franklin about why 1776 is very much a play for 2017.
One of the main obstacles for anyone doing this musical is that you need 30 white men to do the musical. And I thought, well, you know, Hamilton isn't doing it with all these white men. They actually did it contrary to that.
George Washington's an African-American.
Right, and, absolutely.
And so is Aaron Burr.
Yes, and so I thought to myself, well, you know, there have been productions in the past of 1776, all female casts. I've heard of that happening. And so I thought, well, why don't we just mix it up a lot? And so pretty much went into the audition process, a casting whomever we thought would be best for the role, whether they were female, male, or black, brown, white, or whatever.
What'd you come up with?
We have all of those. Reverend Witherspoon is an African-American woman, and John Adams is a white male. The young man that sings Mama Looks Sharp is...
He's Washington
Indian.
Spy,
He's
right?
Indian, yes. Yeah. He's an Indian. And Caesar Rodney is a female. White female. So we have a cornucopia.
Is that going to be hard for the audience to suspend belief because these figures are so iconic?
We're costuming them in period costumes. So that will be the first thing that kind of you feast your eyes on. And I think what hopefully happens and what usually happens if the story is compelling enough is that you accept and you see who the characters are, what they're doing, and you soon just don't worry about that so much.
You're here with Kelly Franklin, who is the dramaturg for the production, and that is the person who researches the role and tries to help the actors get a little bit more into the psyche of the character. Kelly, what have you found out about some of these very famous people in history that struck you?
In researching the show, I found out that the playwright, the man who wrote the original script, was actually a historian himself. He even taught high school history, and so he has all kinds of records and information, and it's all based off of primary sources, the letters that they wrote each other, or the diary entries that they had. So, like, each person is their own individual character.
For 10 years, King George and his parliament have gulled, cullied, and diddled these colonies... And still this Congress refuses to grant any of my proposals on independence, even so much as the courtesy of open debate. Good God, what in hell are they waiting for?
Sit down, John! Sit down, John! For God's sake, John! Sit down! Sit down, John! Sit down, John! For God's sake, John! Sit down!
Someone ought to open up a window!
When 1776 came out, it was kind of a euphoric time in some ways in the country. It was right before the bicentennial, the 200th anniversary of the United States. But it was also, America was coming out of this really rough period of Watergate, which Nixon had just resigned a year or two before. So it was a show really for that time. Do you see it now as a show for our time when people are talking about, well, what does the Constitution say? What are our founding principles?
I do. It's every evening I'm in rehearsal. I sit and listen to the words. And like Kelly said, much of the script is, you know, a narrative comes directly from what they said. We are actually saying some of the things they said. Certainly, we are signing the Declaration of Independence, which we can all read, and to sort of languish in this the brilliance of these men and how they put it all together and what they committed themselves to is sometimes overwhelming and certainly a positive experience of what this country is founded on, the rights that we have and we must hold on to.
Kelly, I'm interested in your perspective as a young person, as a person in your 20s. What did you take away from this show, given the context of all that's happening in our country now, the uncertainty about what kind of country we want to be?
We're still very much in the same place we were then. America is still its own great experiment. It's just now we're reliving a lot of the same and similar feelings. At the end of the day, what I'm concerned about in watching this is, are we going to see the compromise in our lives that they did? They compromised on slavery. They compromised on breaking away. They compromised on, spoiler alert, the actual bird for America. But
which became the eagle and not the turkey.
Right. Or the dove. Living in the state of Illinois, we're still without a budget. Are we going to finally make that compromise? In the federal government, we're both Republicans and Democrats, and no one wants to reach across the aisle. So when our founders understood that compromise is not a weakness, why are we still deeming it one today?
I brought a smart girl with me,
you
didn't
did.
I? Yes, yes.
How quiet the chamber is. How silent the chamber is. Is anybody there? Does anybody care? Does anybody see what I see?
One of the strengths of the show, it seems to me, is that these men who were our founding fathers become very real and very nuanced. Thomas Jefferson, he's a violin player. He just wants to go home to his wife in Virginia. They have this passionate relationship. Ben Franklin drinks a little bit too much. John Adams is sort of an ornery kind of guy. And then there's Abigail. So talk a little bit about how these characters come alive.
Well, Abigail is one of only two characters that are written as female in the play.
Abigail Adams, I should say.
Abigail Adams, and then Mrs. Jefferson, Martha Jefferson as well. Abigail Adams never comes to Philadelphia, which is where the play takes place, because she's at home raising their four children back in Massachusetts. The thing that we know historically about that couple, Abigail and John Adams, is they were very, very close. They wrote letters every day. They were kindred spirits. She was just as smart as he was, and they were quite a pair. And in the play, she comes and she is his sort of guardian angel and his counsel. And she's there for him while she, carries the load of the family back at home. And he makes decisions based on some of her opinions.
Sometimes we see these historical figures as just text, words, of people who are these ideals that once existed in the 1700s, well beyond any of us being born. But then watching them come to life and realizing that, oh, they have flaws just like me.
What do you want people to take away from this production?
I have a feeling that many people my age, around my age, will be humming the tunes because they remember them from when they first were introduced to this piece. But I think I want the majority of everyone, the young and old, to come away with a renewed sense of how great this country can be. And
of our ideals.
Of our ideals and our principles and what we are founded on.
Mr. Secretary, is the declaration ready to be signed?
It is.
Very well. Call the roll.
New Hampshire, Dr. Josiah Bartlett. Massachusetts, Mr. John Adams. Rhode Island.
Kelly,
I'm just hoping people walk away with, again, kind of a renewed sense of patriotism, but also the hope that they will themselves get involved in civic engagement opportunities, be it voting, be it being a part of the system, or even just reading the news is something that I think people can figure out from this show and realize, oh, there's so much going on around me. Maybe I can be a part of it.
Well, maybe there will be a play in a few dozen years called 2016, and and we'll be looking at our history in that way as well.
This play is appropriate for all ages. Please feel free to bring your children and come and enjoy it. It's a beautiful, if you haven't been to the CPA, it's a beautiful theater. We have a gorgeous set that shows us Constitution Hall in Philadelphia. And so come and listen to the music. We have a full orchestra. And enjoy.
Thank you, Lori Adams, the director of the upcoming production at ISU Center for Performing Arts, 1776, and the dramaturg, Kelly Franklin. Thanks a lot for coming in and talking about this.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for letting us come.
I'm Judy Valente.
The musical 1776 is on stage at the ISU Center for the Performing Arts tonight through Saturday at 7:30 p.m. You're listening to one of the more famous ballads from the show, Mama Look Sharp.
The maple tree.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find Judy Valente's interview and the rest of today's show, thanks to Laura Kennedy and Willis Kern, at WGLT.org. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Share your thoughts about the show at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy.